Welcome to Trail Bites for the week of October 22nd, 2020. I'm Gavin Jackson. This mini-pod is a companion piece to the South Carolina Lead, and we're doing this to help keep you up to speed on what is happening on the campaign trail in the Palmetto State. This Trail Bite features the latest on the 1st and 2nd Congressional District races, the U.S. Senate race between Lindsey Graham and Jamie Harrison, as well as a bit on what's happening in several statehouse contests, and how massive fundraising is helping Democrats this cycle and beyond. To help me do all this, we have not one, not two, but three guests. You know them, I know them. They are Meg Kennard of the Associated Press, Jamie Lovegrove of the Post and Courier, and Mayan Schechter of the State Newspaper. Welcome, everyone. This is so great.
Hi, friends.
Hi. It's so nice to hear everybody's together.
The gang's all here.
We're here. We're less than 2 weeks away from Election Day. I can't believe it. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about what we're thankful for at the end of this podcast. But I want to start off with the second congressional district debate between incumbent Republican Joe Wilson and Democratic challenger Adair Ford Burroughs. Jamie, can you kind of give us an idea, a little scene setter for this race? I mean, this is not the first congressional district, or this is the second one right up around here in our area in Columbia nearby. But it has been making some waves, especially with Burroughs consistently out fundraising Wilson. Kind of give us an idea about what's going on with this race for people who haven't been following it closely.
Sure. I wrote a story about this race like a year and a half ago, because when Adair Ford Burroughs got into the race, you know, she was clearly a much stronger recruit than Democrats have typically had in the second congressional district, which has been a safe Republican seat for even longer than the first congressional district had been. So Republicans had held the first congressional district for 40 years before Joe Cunningham won it in 2018. Republicans have held the second congressional district, which, you know, comes to parts of Columbia here, but really stretches all the way out through Aiken and all the way to the Georgia border. And especially is kind of anchored around Lexington, which is very conservative historically. You know, Republicans have held that seat since the early 60s. So it has been a Republican stronghold for a very long time. Adair Ford Burroughs has made it a lot more interesting, again, because of the fact that she does have this compelling personal story of growing up in Williston in a double-wide trailer. You may have seen a lot of TV ads about this, going to Furman and then to Stanford Law School, working for the Department of Justice. She had a compelling personal story. She was also kind of running very much as a moderate Democrat, very much in the same sort of vein as Joe Cunningham did. So my story, you know, a year and a half ago was, this is the Democrats trying to replicate Joe Cunningham's success in an even more conservative district. Now, you know, because of just how conservative it is, no matter how good of a campaign Adair Ford Burroughs runs and has run, she's always going to be a significant underdog there, even more so than Joe Cunningham was in 2018. But that really has been the story of this race, is Democrats trying to take the playbook that they used to succeed in the first congressional district and take it to an even more conservative district up there in the second.
And they just had that debate Tuesday evening. Meg, you and Jamie were watching. Tell me what moments stood out to you. Obviously, only one debate. You know, we did reach out to have both Adair and Joe Wilson on this week in South Carolina for some candidate conversations. Only she accepted, so we are left with things like this that WIS hosted. What did you hear from the candidates, and what stood out to you?
First off, the contrast between these two candidates is apparent, and it's something that Democrats are hoping to seize on. Adair Ford Burroughs is significantly younger than Joe Wilson. She has a lot of energy. She's very excited. She's very passionate. And that came through definitely when the two of them were up there talking. Joe Wilson speaks a lot from his experience base and pointed many times toward foreign policy issues that he's worked on, trips he's made abroad into war zones to Afghanistan, work he's done with President Trump, you know, so kind of the contrast there. But I mean, debates, you know, sometimes they just kind of cruise right on along. Sometimes there are a couple moments that stand out. And in this one, they got into a pretty impassioned discussion when it came to abortion and when the moderators were asking, you know, what their thoughts were on abortion, and both kind of pointed toward somewhat personal experiences, not necessarily themselves, but people that they know. Joe Wilson talked about somebody he knew who had been adopted instead of aborted and gone on to become a successful business leader. And Adair Ford Burroughs talked about a friend of hers who had to make a difficult decision in terminating a pregnancy that was life-threatening. And one of her quotes that I pulled out when they were talking about late-term abortion, And she said, you know, what the Republican Party has said, no, you have to have a stillbirth that might kill you. And, you know, I mean, those are very strong words, but that kind of shows you the kind of passion and fire, really, that she was bringing to that discussion. I wanted to go back to something Jamie just said really quickly about the first district and contrasting that some with the second. It's no accident that a lot of the playbook for Democrats in pinging from their success in the first district in 2018 and trying to bring that forward into the second district this go around, that's no accident. There are even some of the same players who have been working on both of these campaigns. The ads that Adair Ford Burroughs has put forth this cycle are very polished and very well put together and are very familiar because she's got some of the same ad makers that Joe Cunningham was using last go around. So again, you know, Democrats, as Jamie noted, have got this win under their belts from last cycle, and they're really starting to try to spin forward some of that success, you know, they hope, into this district and maybe even beyond.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt when you're bringing in the money like she is as well. So that's something, you know, a normal amount of money, I guess, for a race compared to the Senate race, which we can talk about in a minute. Just a complete different amount of money there, a different world. You know, talking about $2 million compared to, what, $86 million, I think, overall right at this point.
The numbers really don't even make sense anymore. It's just, I don't, can we count that high? I don't know.
Well, you want to talk about some other numbers. Let's talk about first congressional district polling numbers. I know everyone loves polls, you know, especially you, Meg.
I want to talk about
how Nancy Mace on Monday, she touted a poll that gave her a 2-point advantage over Joe Cunningham. The poll was conducted by Strategic National from October 14th through 16th. That's a much tighter poll than what we saw done for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in early October, which gave Joe Cunningham a massive 13-point lead. Jamie, when you look at these numbers, when you look at these polls and who they've been paid for and who they're done by, what can people take away? Should we just split the difference here and kind of find somewhere in the middle at this point when we look at these numbers?
That's probably a pretty good guess of where things actually are. You know, whenever you get internal polls from either side, it's safe to assume that they are at least a few points skewed in favor of whoever was requesting the poll. You know, I mean, look, candidates and campaigns want to have an accurate sense of what the state of their race is. They don't want a poll that is going to make them look better than they are generally, because, you know, it's going to guide their strategy. And if they are inaccurately looking at the state of the race, that they're going to be making incorrect judgments. But yes, typically when partisan pollsters and partisan campaigns conduct polls, it's much less reliable than public polls. You know, regardless of the polls, I think it's safe to say at this point that Democrats feel very good about the state of this race, which we, you know, for a long time was viewed as a real 50-50 toss-up. The Cook Political Report, which is a, you know, nonpartisan election handicapper, has moved it to lean Democratic. Joe Cunningham is clearly, I think, in the driver's seat at this point. That race has dropped out of a lot of national rankings of the top 10 most likely districts to flip. And, you know, part of that is because it's been such a similar race to what we saw in 2018. There was, I think, a lot of debate after 2018 about what the Republican Party should do and how they should approach trying to win it back. Should they try to kind of tack more to the middle and kind of go with a completely different approach? But we have not really seen that. It's been very similar to the campaign that we saw in 2018. And not only has it been similar, but this time Joe Cunningham actually has a record under his belt. He has several votes and several prominent votes in which he has split with Democratic leadership that he can point to and use as evidence of his bipartisanship. You know, certainly as Nancy Mace has pointed out, he does vote with Democrats a lot of the time, but he is, you know, one of the more bipartisan members of the House. And so, you know, all of that has combined to give him at least a couple points advantage as we head into these last couple weeks.
Yeah, and you know, just one thing that occurs to me too, let's remember the Republicans trained their sights on winning that district back before Joe Cunningham had even been sworn in as congressman in the first district. They made it very clear that they were going to be mounting an aggressive campaign, moving full-time staff into the first district to really work on winning that seat back. And if that doesn't work out for them this go around, then I would imagine the South Carolina Republican Party is going to need to do a little bit of soul searching in terms of what their efforts will look like moving forward to win back any seats that might flip the first district, perhaps this go around. But if they were to lose any others down down the road, what their sort of what their efforts and what their campaigns are going to need to look like when they try to get those back into their win column.
Definitely. And actually, just one last thing I would add about that is after this cycle, there will be redistricting. So we don't actually even know necessarily specifically what the first district is going to look like in 2022. And the results of this race will really also determine how both Republicans and Democrats fight in terms of the district lines to decide whether or not they want to make this a more Democratic seat, a less Democratic seat. It can get very complicated. But the point is, you know, this election will have consequences for the first congressional district for many years to come.
Never a dull moment.
Yeah. As long as they keep Charleston in that district, I think Joe will be still sitting pretty pretty. I mean, obviously, he, you know, really that's where he really won in 2018 compared to the other counties in that district. But when we look at the fundraising for this entire cycle for the first congressional district ending September 30th, Cunningham raised about $6 million, has $1.2 million on hand for the final stretch. Nancy Mace raised $4.4 million, had $1.7 million on hand going into the final 2 months here. And, you know, she did outraise him in the third quarter. We also just saw a fundraiser with Nikki Haley and Nancy Mace down in Hilton Head. None of us went because we weren't invited. That's okay.
Thanks a lot.
I guess that's how things work, even though Nikki Haley is holding plenty of fundraisers across the country where the press is invited. That's cool. It's whatever. We don't care. Anyway, but when we, again, kind of talk about what we're talking about with the Cook Political Report making this race, you know, favor Cunningham a little bit, Jamie, I'm assuming that we're going to see a lot of that money pretty much spent in this race. I mean, Joe's not going to really be Mark Sanford here and have $1 million left in the bank after he, you know, come November 4th.
No, all the money is going to be spent on this. I mean, you know, let's not forget the reason why Mark Sanford did not spend all of his money was, well, A, because he is an extremely frugal man.
Very hungry.
But B, because he didn't think he was going to have a close race. You know, that primary really snuck up on him. It was only towards the end of it that he realized he was really in trouble. Joe Cunningham and Nancy Mace are both well aware of the fact that this is an extremely competitive race. And generally, when you have an extremely competitive race, you do not leave money on the table. I expect they will both have approximately $0 cash on hand by the time we get to November 3rd. And people in the first congressional district are going to see a whole lot of ads between now
that
and
blitz.
Then.
Mm-hmm. So again, we don't have a Senate debate determined. We were supposed to have it this evening. You know, scheduling, dealing with the confirmation hearings, and obviously the vote on Thursday. And then, of course, you know, we are within 2 weeks of the election. It's hard to kind of pin down another date, even though there's been some back and forth. We still don't have one. But we did see both Senate candidates out on the campaign trail over the past few days, kind of like old times. You know, we did see masks. We didn't see any handshaking. We had a drive-in rally instead of people packed into stands. It was like old times out there, Meg. So let's first go to North Charleston, where you were with me at the Bend, which is a big open grass field with a picturesque view of the Ashley River, which was a backdrop for a stage that featured several Democratic candidates, including Jamie Harrison, who was the keynote. Now, what did you hear from voters out there in their cars while they were honking, and also maybe some things from Harrison as well during this rally? It's the first time we've really seen a rally of this sort in a while.
Yeah, it was kind of neat. Having some flashbacks a little bit, since that's the same place where we had the Blue Jam with all the presidential hopefuls, however many months ago that was. So, you know, everything runs together and this year never ends and that's it. But there was a lot of good energy. It was different to be at a drive-in rally. Some of the candidates, Joe Biden included, have been trying those out around the country since campaigning is a little different during the pandemic. Lots of honks, still lots of cheers, lots of signs. But there was some good flavor. And, you know, I wasn't really sure what to make of it going into it, but voters seemed very excited. They were very, very jazzed about seeing Jamie Harrison. It had been since the end of October, since he had really done in-person campaigning due to the pandemic, a lot of virtual events, but nothing certainly of this scale in person. And so to have that chance to get out there and to see this candidate that they either support already or are thinking about, and also the guy who's been in all the headlines for raising all this money, to be out there on a beautiful day and to have the chance to really see him up close and personal, people were very excited about that. On his part, Jamie Harrison gave a very what I would consider, you know, pretty typical campaign speech for him, But, you know, he was excited and brought the energy and talked about his personal story, which all of us have heard many times by this point, but may still be new to some voters who don't have a television or a cell phone or are near an internet connection. But he got down into some of that and was introduced by Jim Clyburn, who obviously is a U.S. House Majority Whip, somebody that Jamie's interned for, worked for, apparently has known since he was an 11th grader, according to the congressman. And so that was a nice personal touch to that, too. So, again, for Democrats, it kind of did feel like old times. This is pretty close to, you know, the old time campaign trail that we remember from the past couple of years, as we've seen recently. And certainly, Jamie is hoping to capitalize on some of that energy. He's got another drive-in style event coming up. So, yeah, here we are in the home stretch and actually seeing these candidates in person, which is something new and different, at least for lately.
And a big thing that folks have been asking Harrison is his use of campaign money to support third party candidate Bill Bledsoe, who is no longer in the race, but appears on the ballot. Jamie, you were out there at the polls with Jamie Harrison on Monday when he voted absentee in person. You asked him about this specifically, about how they're spending money to kind of sway these ultra conservative voters. Just tell me a little bit about what their goal is to do with this campaign, essentially funded, which, you know, Jamie Harrison, I support this message at the end of these campaign ads for that they're trying to tout another third party candidate to woo voters from Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, well, you know, in the words of Jessica Taylor, who I talked to from the Cook Political Report, this is what you can do when you have $57 million to spend.
Yeah,
is you can start to get creative. We have seen efforts like this in other states before. So basically what he's been doing is these quote unquote attack ads that are not really designed to be attack ads. They are really designed to elevate the profile of this guy, Bill Bledsoe, who is technically on the ballot, but has stopped running and endorsed Lindsey Graham in this race, said that, you know, he has the support of President Trump. He's voted to, confirm conservative judicial appointees. And so, you know, he has his support. What we've seen in a lot of polls of this race pretty consistently is that Senator Graham is not as popular among Republican voters as Trump is. Which suggests that there are still a small contingent of Republican voters in South Carolina who are on Graham's right and would like him to be even more conservative than he is. Those types of voters are not very likely to cast a ballot for Jamie Harrison, a Democrat. If they're more conservative than Lindsey Graham, they're not going to vote for a Democrat. But what they could do is either not vote in the Senate race, just vote for Trump and then leave the voting booth, or they could cast their ballot for this other name on the ballot. He'll actually be on the top of the ballot because of a rotational system, this guy, Bill Bledsoe. So what Jamie Harrison has started doing is in digital ads and now on TV ads as well, has run ads about how this guy, Bill Bledsoe, is too conservative for South Carolina. He supported Trump from day one, and he is against all abortions, and he's pro-Second Amendment. Those are all the type of things that, of course, a lot of conservative voters in South Carolina would really like to see in a candidate. And, you know, to folks on Graham's right, that may be very appealing to them. That's clearly the approach that they are going with there. So they're quote unquote attack ads, but they're really elevating his profile. Interestingly, Lindsey Must Go PAC, a super PAC supporting Jamie Harrison, is going even more directly. They've been sending out mailers just explicitly advocating for Bill Bledsoe, clearly trying to get conservative voters to give him a look. So what I asked Jamie was, you know, what's your goal here? And do you not think this is a little deceptive, the fact that you are running these ads about this candidate who's actually not even really running? Because that's certainly what Lindsey Graham's response has been. And he said, no, you know, he doesn't think this is deceptive, that this is just he's trying to educate voters about people, everyone who's on the ballot. And he said, look, I'm old enough to remember that third party candidates can have an impact on the races. So this has been done before, and it's a strategy they're kind of looking at to potentially peel away Republican votes from Lindsey Graham, because a lot of Democrats in South Carolina believe that they will admit that it's going to be very hard for Jamie Harrison in a state like South Carolina to get more than 50% of the vote. But if they can get to 47, 48% of the vote and win because of the fact that this this third party candidate gets 3 or 4% of the vote and Lindsey Graham gets 46, 47, that's a scenario they see as much more plausible.
Well, and let's keep in mind, too, there will be voters in South Carolina who, regardless of any of these efforts, regardless of the other people on the ballot, will always choose the third option, will vote against major parties just because. So regardless of how much Jamie Harrison's effort works and this whole argument toward the more conservative candidate, Bill Bledsoe is still going to get some of those votes. And so that makes it even more interesting.
There's always going to be protest votes for sure.
Definitely going to be something we all watch closely when those election results come in. Mayan, I want to get you to jump in here. We were talking about on Saturday, we heard from several Democratic state Senate and House candidates, such as Folly Beach Representative Spencer Wetmore, who represents the 115th District, formerly occupied by Republican Peter McCoy. We also heard from North Charleston Representative J.A. Moore, who's seeking to hold on to his seat he flipped, and Sam Skardon, who was gunning for Senator Sandy Senn's seat. Well, that's a tricky one, which represents much of James and John's Islands. You had a big piece on Sunday, Mayan, about these closed statehouse races that Dems are looking to hold on to and others that they're trying to flip. And a lot of it is centered in the Lowcountry. We heard from Trav Roberts and kind of talk about how this is all going to kind of move from the Lowcountry throughout the state, hopefully at some point. I want to get your thoughts on what you're reporting, what your reporting showed, and then just what you're hearing in terms of the efforts behind these movements to flip and hold on to these districts.
Yeah, and I think Meg and Jamie have sort of some of it up. I mean, first and foremost, now I can't use exactly the same language because it's public radio that Trav typically uses. Candidates and campaigns, but I think we can all agree this is the first year in a long time where Democrats have run a lot of highly competitive candidates. And as you mentioned, we're seeing a lot of them in the first district, which is a sort of a shifting district politically anyway. But this is the first time in a long time that we're seeing very, very strategic, well-fundraised candidates run, including in the second district, which is obviously not the first district. But like you mentioned, Adair Ford Burroughs has been able to out-fundraise the incumbent Joe Wilson. So I think that's first and foremost of this sort of winning cocktail that Democrats feel like they've been able to really work on for the last 2.5, 3 years. But I think what cannot be overlooked and what certainly will help any candidate is cash. There is so much money that has been flowing into South Carolina since during the primary when you had 20 plus candidates trying to win over South Carolina Democratic voters. And so certainly a lot of that money can have some real impact on down ballot races. And what we've seen with Jamie Harrison's ability to fundraise, and as Meg, you tweeted maybe a couple of weeks ago or a week or so ago, whenever his third quarter numbers came in, his campaign told you that some of the cash that's going to be remaining is going to be used to mobilize Black voter turnout. Mm-hmm. That certainly obviously has a lot of down ballot impact. So I think that leads into like the third factor is that it's a presidential year. You're going to see a higher turnout than normal. But the fact that South Carolina also has this hugely competitive high stakes Senate race that, I mean, a year ago, I think we would have all just been like completely unsure of the fact if someone would have told us that there were going to be polls that showed a toss up. And so now that you have that, you obviously have more voters interested. You have a lot of cash coming in, which certainly can help boost that turnout. And we've seen these long lines at voter registration offices and satellite offices in various counties where absentee numbers are incredibly high. You have people who are taking advantage of the fact that the legislature expanded absentee voting to every single voter. And you also have voters, frankly, who are very sort of worried and concerned about the postal service process. And so they're showing up to vote beforehand and skipping the lines also on election day. And I think also what can't be overlooked, and this is something that the first district is certainly latching on, is a bit of the souring attitude on the president. Now, while you may have voters who are supportive of the president's policies, maybe they're not super supportive of his rhetoric or his tweets. And so that can certainly have an impact and help the Democratic Party as they aim to flip a bunch of seats in the statehouse this year. Now, on the flip side, Republicans, see some of the same things working in their favors. For example, you know, Shane Massey, the Senate Majority Leader, noted to me that, I mean, while the first district, while Charleston may be a bit more blue, more purple, the rest of the state is still red. That still works in their favor. And so they're, for example, looking to flip a couple of upstate seats in the Senate. And that's an area where Republicans have certainly done much better, especially in presidential years. These are areas where Trump has seen success. Republicans also have money flowing in. That can certainly help them. And on top of that, Republican voters are very dedicated voters that show up to vote at higher, obviously, percentages every year. And so we're seeing a large sect of Republican voters showing up and likely, just like Democrats, voting straight party tickets. So these are all areas that certainly help both parties. But I think this is the first time in a while where Democrats really believe they have leverage. And going back a little bit on the cash too, it's not just, you know, folks like Jamie Harrison who have been able to raise a lot of money. We're also seeing these candidates running for House seats, running for state Senate seats, where the numbers, the margin between the number of Democrats and Republicans could shrink, especially this year. We're seeing them also, not necessarily out fundraise their Republican challengers, but raise a lot of money, more money than maybe House or Senate candidates are used to raising. So it's certainly a much more competitive year in the state House than I can remember in a while.
And again, those margins, at least in the Senate, I mean, the Senate's a little bit closer there. When you look at who, you know, how many, you know, what's like 27 Republicans, 19 Democrats. You go over to the House, there's 78 Republicans, 45 Democrats. So again, we can talk about redistricting later, but again, that's all kind of, a lot of that stuff is already preset. Again, we're looking at some select races that could change there, but again, it's going to be a lot to flip any kind of majority or get a super majority at this point. Yeah. I do want to add, Mayon, you're talking about all that money flowing in. We're talking about the Harrison race. If you look at the FEC filings, right, you know, Harrison has raised $86 million. $4.5 million has gone from his campaign account, yep, to the state Democratic, yep, Party. So it's like, I mean, that's totally legal. It's totally cool. That's what he's there for. I mean, these out-of-state donors are really not only helping him get on the airwaves, but more importantly, they're kind of building, you could say rebuilding, the Democratic Party in South Carolina for this race, for next, 2022, other statewide races, down ballot races. I mean, it's huge ramifications from this money when we talk about, oh my gosh, all the airwaves, you know, it's like,
that's part of what it takes. I mean, when Democrats talk about, you know, really gaining some traction and some airspace in South Carolina, that's how it starts. And so to have a campaign like Jamie's that's bringing in all this cash and able to share it, Democrats are excited not only about this time, but really what that means for the future.
And if I could just add two real quick points, you know, one, it's just kind of an ironic thing, which is the fact that Jamie Harrison, of course, spent several years as the chairman of the South Carolina Democratic Party and struggled to raise all this money, which they really needed for these races. Turns out all he needed to do was actually just run for office himself, and then he could raise $1 billion and he could fund it back into the party. And now the party has way more money than they've ever had. This is an incredible moment for the state party. You know, the second point is just, after this election is over, just one point that I think can't be neglected, and you hear some Democrats kind of quietly talk about this. They would never want to say this on the record before this election, but, you know, they've always said that if they had the money, they could compete. They could change South Carolina. Resources is what we're missing, right? So the stakes are really high for them, because if Jamie Harrison loses, if they do not pick up these state Senate seats, that's going to disprove the theory that they have been touting for many years. And it's going to be, frankly, even harder to get candidates to run for office. If they say, look, Jamie Harrison raised $86 million and he couldn't win, you know, what does that say to future potential candidates? So the stakes are really high for Democrats to prove themselves right here.
Yeah. They can also play the card right where it's not a typical election year either, right? They're not out there barnstorming every day, day in, day out. It's really different. It's also kind of hamstringing them. You know, it's you get all this money coming in, then all of a sudden you can't really do what you want to do with it, though they are trying. You know, they're doing this, you know, all-in tour across the state as well. So trying to rally people up there. Did someone else want to jump in?
I was just going to say, and I think that's the point, like while Democrats in South Carolina are being particularly quiet about it, I mean, that's what Republicans are drumming quite loudly, is that, yeah, I mean, sure, you're seeing these pockets of the state turning or shifting a little bit, but the state is still a red state. It's very tough to have a Democrat elected statewide. We've seen the struggles that the Democratic Party has been in since 1998 and even after 2006. Alongside that, you know, this is something that we've sort of talked about in this, you know, this growing kind of verbal expression of well, this, the state is turning purple. It's turning blue. And as former Governor Hodges said to me, you know, the last Democrat to win, to hold the governor's office, said it's a red state until you win. And so, like you were mentioning, Jamie, I mean, the stakes are very, very high for Democrats in South Carolina this year.
Trav even told me, you know, we're not even a purple state. We're just an independent state that happens to vote Republican a lot. And, you know, and it's also been because we haven't had the best candidates. So, again, going back to what Jamie, you were saying about just making sure that you can really sell it this year with all the money coming in. I'd definitely be close. And that's going to be something I think, you know, people will point to regardless of the outcome of just how close it is going forward and trying to make it work for other statewide races.
You know, there is an effect of going from top of the ballot down, and the fact that Jamie's race is very close has an impact on these down ballot races. You know, there are some Democratic strategists who also really believe that the fact that there are so many competitive down ballot races has a positive impact up high. Mm-hmm. And notably, actually, one Democratic strategist I was talking to recently noted that Republicans recruited a lot of candidates this year in fairly safe Democratic state house districts, or districts particularly with a lot of African-American voters. And there's one Democratic strategist who thought that that had really been kind of an own goal for Republicans because of the fact that they are now running contested races in safe Democratic districts, that's going to draw more Democratic voters to come and vote in those races and will help broader with the statewide effort. So it'll be interesting to see not just the top-down effects of the ballot, but the down-top effects.
It works both ways.
Meg, I want to get into, we're wrapping up here too. I know it's a long one, but hey, there's a lot of stuff going on. Meg, I want to talk to you about, you know, we also saw Senator Graham out on the campaign trail. We saw him holding rallies in North Charleston, Columbia, Simpsonville, just over the past few days. Expect some more in the future too. He's of course really been driving home his message of getting Amy Coney Barrett through his committee. Obviously that vote is Thursday, but it seems like it's already a bit of a victory tour for Senator Graham.
That's kind of what it sounds like. And at every one of these rallies, we see people with signs that say, fill the seat. And there's one guy I've seen a couple times with a homemade We Love ACB for We Love Amy Coney Barrett sign. The court obviously plays a major role in everything that's going on in the Senate campaign right now, but particularly for Senator Graham, because when he left the Simpsonville rally, he said, look, I'm not coming back to this state until she's on the court. So, you know, that right there, again, we've talked about before, Senator Graham isn't spending the last couple of weeks of this campaign campaigning. He's doing his day job up in D.C., helming this whole confirmation process. So, yeah, we've seen a lot of Senator Graham taking credit where credit is due for what appears to be a successful nomination process for Amy Coney Barrett, and also really hammering back home that thing that Republican and conservative voters tell you is very important to them, which is a conservative court and having more conservative judges and justices appointed. Senator Graham obviously plays a very crucial role in that process as the chairman of Judiciary and as one of President Donald Trump's top allies in Congress. So, yes, he is up there reminding people, look, this is what you guys wanted. It's what you said that you really needed up here in Congress. This is what I'm doing. So, P.S., don't forget that when you go to vote on November 3rd.
And I've been talking to some voters who have, you know, previously voted for Graham and then, you know, they said they're fed up with him this go around, you know, because he's not holding true to his word. I know that's probably, you know, music to Jamie Harrison's ears. Mm-hmm. But of course, you also have plenty of Republicans who are saying that's politics. That's what they do. We're going to vote for him because we're fearful of where the country could go if the Senate falls, et cetera, et cetera. Just want to talk to you guys really quick. Anyone else talking to voters and maybe what they're hearing, Jamie, if you've been out and about or just people at the Graham rallies?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, just to piggyback off the court thing, there are voters who, and this has been really central to Graham's closing argument here is, you know, he made an interesting comment, I thought, during that stop in North Charleston. He said, you know, this race is not a personality contest. This has real policy implications. And he was reminding folks about all these conservative judges he's confirmed and saying that, you know, Jamie Harrison will not vote to confirm these judges if he is elected. And you know, I do hear from some voters, again, folks who traditionally vote for Republicans who say, you know, I really don't like Trump's character and I don't like the fact that Senator Graham has latched on to him the way that he has, but I am still fundamentally conservative. I care about conservative courts and I care about conservative policies. And so as much as I may prefer the character of Jamie Harrison, you know, I can't leave Graham because of that fact. And that is really what exactly what Graham is really trying to drive home here at the end. And it's not dissimilar to what Trump did and Trump has done in his own campaigns, you know, has said, you know, Republicans may not love the tweets. They may not love everything else, but there was a reason why before the 2016 election, Trump put out a list of judges that he would consider confirming to the Supreme or nominating to the Supreme Court. It was to remind those fundamentally conservative voters about the policy implications that these elections have.
I think we're going to have to leave it there unless anyone else wanted any final thoughts here going once, twice. Okay, Mayan, before we get out of this, let's talk about favorite Halloween candies. You are a big peanut M&M fan, correct?
Partial to peanut M&Ms, but and this is really why I came on the podcast today. I'm a big Reese's Cup fan.
Yes.
And her Meg yes. will back me up soon after regular 100%. M&M hot trash.
Yes.
That is accurate. Reese's peanut butter cups for life.
Yes.
Peanut M&Ms are the only ones that are worthwhile, and regular M&Ms are hot garbage.
Do you have a favorite candy, Meg? Halloween? What are you giving out at your house?
I mean, it has to have chocolate in it if I'm going to give it out. But I always buy a huge bag of the full size Reese's peanut butter cups, not those little wimpy, tiny, teeny
Rich.
Ones. You get full size candy here in Blythewood.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, and I don't know really how this is going to work with COVID and you know everything,
yeah.
and if we're going to have some sort of like intermediary way to parcel out the candy to the trick or treaters, but they will yeah. be getting plenty of Reese's peanut butter cup goodness from this house.
And yeah, and no one puts out the whole bowl because that's gone after two kids. Jamie Lovegrove, take us out. Tell us your favorite candy, what you guys might be giving out. Do kids even come by your house down in Rosewood where you guys are at?
I will find
no one comes
out.
By my house.
I'm not sure. But I went to Greenwood this past weekend to go see a double feature of It and It 2 at the Greenwood
Ooh,
Drive-In.
Yeah.
Yeah. First time I've gotten to really kind of see a movie in that setting in a long time. And when I was there, I went to the concession stand and got some Mike and Ikes, which really
Ooh.
Reminded me. I like those.
Edgy.
I am really, yeah.
Definitely.
I like I also like Haribo, like all kinds of different
yep.
Gummy stuff. I like chocolate as much as the next person, but yep. I could spice it up a little bit and toss in some gummy treats as
what
well.
What about, I have a question. What about Swedish fish?
Sure. Yes.
I like Swedish fish too. Yes.
I think they kind of taste like plastic,
everyone.
But I also like them. So that's weird.
Yeah.
I've been editing a lot and I've been just going through the Tootsie Roll Pops, you know, just you get the crunch, you get the chew, you get the sugar. That's all
How
I
How many
know,
licks
so.
Does it
Between
take?
Between that, one, two, three, crunch right into it. Between the Tootsie Pops and the scotch, that's pretty much where I'm at right now. Thank you again to all of our listeners and, of course, our guests, Meg Kinnard with the AP, Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier, and Mayan Schechter with the State Newspaper. Less than 2 weeks ago, folks.
Are we going to make it?
2 weeks. That's a great question.
I don't know.
We'll find out.
I've you guys cleared a big hump. Wow, wasn't that great? Wasn't that great hearing about everyone's favorite candies? And I guess, you know, like 30 minutes about what's going on in politics in South Carolina. But the candy, you know, that's great to hear. But we want to hear about your voting experiences and who you're voting for, what it's been like voting absentee, or how you're going to vote on Election Day. Tell us your top issues. We want to know. Leave us a message at 803-563-7169. Also, be sure to follow me on Twitter at Gavin Jackson for candidate updates. And just a reminder, Campaign Trails is not biased toward any candidate or campaign. We're just covering these candidates as they come through and as we can get to them. We're out there trying to get as much information for you so you can make your own decision in 2020. We'll bring you this mini-pod every time there's campaign trail activity in the state, which means up through Election Day, folks. Let us know your thoughts on Twitter at SCLeadPod and follow us with the same handle on Instagram for photos from the campaign trail, our dank memes, and so much more. Campaign Trail Bites is a production of the South Carolina Lead. I'm Gavin Jackson. Oh, gross. Just do your mark.